You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Alan Hollinghurst won the Booker Prize in 2004 for his novel, The Line of Beauty, and his loyal readers have been eagerly awaiting his next novel ever since. Now, 7 years later, The Stranger's Child has just been published by Knopf. It tells the story of a young poet, Cecil Valence, who dies in combat during World War I, and how his literary reputation fares in the decades after his death. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Hollinghurst back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, great to be back here.
And you were here right after The Line of Beauty won the Booker Prize in 2004, and I asked you at the time whether you thought the Booker would change your life, and you said, ask me in a few years. So has winning it changed your life?
I think it did change it in some ways, yes. It gave me a lot of new readers, and it kind of took over. Yes, it was just after I saw you. It kind of took over the next 2 years of my life, really, traveling around the world and talking about that book until I couldn't bear the sound of its name any longer.
The book tour can be very demanding on a major scale.
But I felt it was a great kind of encouragement, really. I was very cheered up by it.
Well, does it make it more difficult for you to win another Booker? This one was long-listed for this year's Booker, and many people were dismayed when it didn't make the shortlist.
Why did it not? I mean, it's really not something I can speculate about decently, I don't think.
You've published 5 novels in 23 years. It's been 7 years since your last novel was published. So you lost 2 years, but have you been working on this all that time?
It took me about 4 years from the start of writing to finishing, I think, yes. I mean, I'm always very, very slow, and this is a long book, which grew to be twice the length I'd originally planned, so.
Because you want to live with your characters for a long time in order to make them come alive?
I don't think it's necessarily that. It's just perhaps I'm rather slow-witted. I don't know. But it takes me a long while to make one paragraph follow another.
Well, reviewers invariably call your books beautifully written. So do you write a lot of drafts, or do you try to just get each sentence and each paragraph exactly right the first time, kind of the way Madame Bovary was written?
Yes, I don't want to sound precious about it, but it's more the latter, yes. I mean, I sometimes wish I was one of those writers who could just dash off a complete draft of a book and then totally rewrite it. But actually, I crawl along trying to get it right the first time.
It's been said that the subject of this book is an alternative and specifically gay literary history of Britain in the 20th century. Was that what you set out to do when you began writing it?
It's one of the things that it's about, isn't it? I mean, there's a gay love story in the early part of the book set before the Great War. Something which can't be talked about at all at the time. And then we see in successive episodes dotted through the century how the sense of that subject is coming more and more into the open and can be talked about, perhaps almost talked about to excess in the end.
Well, homosexuality was a criminal act until 1967.
That's right.
So you wrote your graduate thesis on 3 gay writers who people knew by 1967 had been gay, E.M. Forster, Ronald Furbank, and L.P. Hartley. So is this a fictional exploration of that territory?
I think it is in a way. And the first part of the book, I think, goes quite a lot to Forster, and I was aware of being in his territory, sort of set in the outer suburbs of London, young Cambridge figures, and their sort of intense relationships with each other. Of course, I allow myself to do things which Forster couldn't do. I mean, you say that people knew Forster was gay, but of course, I don't think anyone said that publicly until after his death in 1970 or 71.
Out of respect for him, or because he had been closeted?
It just wouldn't have been said. Yes, I think out of a kind of respect, he hadn't said it publicly himself. I mean, that sexual offences Act of 1967 was a very important thing in our social history, I think, and the middle part of this new book is set just on the eve of that thing, which is going to make a whole lot of things possible to say, which are not possible in the period of the earlier part of the book.
And one of your epigraphs is from E.M. Forster.
That's right, yeah.
But many people see a key figure here, Cecil Valence, as being kind of like Rupert Brooke. Was he the model, more or less?
I certainly wanted to use various things which fascinated me about Brooke, the person who's... I mean, Brooke was more beautiful than Cecil is, but the person who's physically very magnetic has perhaps a rather slender literary gift, but who by dying young becomes denatured in a way into a kind of icon of lost youth. And the very fascinating thing that then happens to the reputation of a poet who has been so treated, and the vested interests which want to preserve this icon, and the very long time it takes for the truth about them actually to be told.
Well, so this is also about the way a writer's reputation can rise and fall throughout the years. I'm not going to ask you what you think about what's going to happen to your own literary reputation, but in the case of Brooke, he wrote a very famous poem, and then died in World War I, and suddenly he became an iconic figure.
That's right.
Also, yeah. Because he was so good-looking?
That played a huge part. I mean, he was extraordinarily beautiful. And so he was ripe for being adopted as a sort of emblematic figure of the golden youth of a lost generation.
I always have thought that he was gay. It was that kind of like an open secret?
Well, I think he was clearly bisexual, and that nothing was ever really said about that until quite recently. He had very difficult relations with a lot of women. I mean, I think his letters, which I slightly modelled Cecil's letters on in my book, with them are fascinating documents of his sort of accusing them all the time of the very attraction which he exercises over them. It was only, I think, in the 90s that some very explicit letters in which he described gay sexual experiences that he'd had were published.
Before Cecil leaves, he writes a poem called 2 Acres, named after the home of the people who are at the center of this novel.
Yeah.
It's been said that the poem resembles Rupert Brooke's poem, The Old Vicarage, Grantchester. So you, as someone with a background in poetry, you could play with that idea?
Yes, the poem is clearly a poem of that kind, and it's in the same form, little rhyming couplets, and it's similarly a poem written before the war, which after the war, again, comes to seem like an emblem of the lost England of the pre-war period.
But it must have been a lot easier for you to write something that was reminiscent of Rupert Brooke than of perhaps T.S. Eliot or somebody who's...
Well, of course. I mean, I think it's very unwise to invent a major writer in a novel because, A, you have to come up with their major works, and B, you have to insinuate them into a pre-existing literary history which doesn't seem to feature them, and in which they've made no impact. So I think it's, you know, it's much easier to invent a second-rate writer.
The scope of this novel seems broader than your earlier works. You look at the rise and fall of a poet's reputation from the early 20th century to today. That's almost a full century. Why did you decide to tackle such a long time period? The story's divided into 5 sections, 1913, 1926, 1967, 1980, and 2008.
It grew out of an initial thing that I wanted to write something about war, but something which didn't actually have the war in it. And my initial idea was to have an episode set just before the Great War and then to rejoin those of the characters who survived perhaps 10 years after the war and see what had happened to them in between. Then when I saw that it was going to have this question of the changes in a reputation of a particular individual and in the social and moral context in which they were understood, I saw that the thing had to go on over the full century. But the book moves in these quite short episodes with very long gaps in between them, which I hope are fascinating and disconcerting to the reader who has to get their bearings every time they start a new section.
Well, it's often before the actual thing happens, before the war, before the decriminalization
exactly.
of homosexuality. But you say that you realized at a certain point that this book was about the rise and fall of a writer's reputation, among other things. Is that something that occurred to you as you were writing the book?
No, in the planning stage, yeah. It's very much a book about memory, too. I mean, I think it's a book I probably wouldn't have written 10 years ago. I'm more and more struck by the fallibility of my own memory and the shakiness of memory as a basis for history. So I wanted, by the end of the book, those who survive from the early part of the book to have as the reader will see, a very shaky grasp on what had actually happened to them.
My guest is Alan Hollinghurst, whose latest novel is called The Stranger's Child. It is published by Knopf, and it has been receiving rave reviews. I don't know, do you read your reviews?
I do, actually, yes. I mean, I bring out a book so rarely that I'm always quite interested to see how it fares when it goes out into the world.
So what happens when you just receive all of this praise? Do you think, gee, what a smart boy am I?
Well, the praise has not been undiluted, actually. There have been quite a few stings in the tails of some of the reviews.
I haven't seen those. Yeah. When we first meet Cecil in 1913, he's visiting the home of a Cambridge family, George Saul, for the weekend. What's their relationship like?
Well, nobody else in this weekend knows, of course, but they are having a passionate affair, and it's... The first part of the book, I think, is a sort of a comedy of sexual misapprehensions where various people have got the wrong idea about each other, and this sort of central relationship goes unguessed by all the other people who are present.
But there are a lot of differences between these two. Cecil is older than George. Also, there's a class difference between them. Cecil is upper class. George is solidly middle class. So that creates some kind of a power imbalance.
I think it does, yes. The Saul family are rather overawed by the arrival of this glamorous visitor. And Daphne, George's younger sister in particular, is sort of fascinated by this, somewhat unlike anybody she's met before.
And Cecil flirts with her. She's 16 years old. Is that because at the time it was important for a man not to seem to be only interested in women, or... you said earlier you think perhaps Rupert Brooke, maybe Cecil, is also bisexual?
Yes, I mean, I wouldn't want to press the Brooke parallel too hard. Yes, I think he's someone who just has a high sex drive and very high self-esteem and a kind of feels a droit de seigneur over anybody that crosses his path.
Your previous books were noted for their graphic sex scenes, but reviews have noted that this novel is much tamer in that respect. Is that just because of the subject matter, or have you changed?
I don't know, tameness is the word. Yes, I mean, I partly felt I'd done that, you know, and I made a point in my earlier novels of writing very openly about gay sexual behaviour and so on, and partly because it hadn't really been done very much before in Britain, and certainly within the context of literary fiction. And I just, you know, I don't want to keep repeating myself. But there's also a deeper reason, I think, in this book, which is that so much of it is about the unknowability of other people's behaviour. And I wanted the reader often to be as uncertain of just what had happened behind a closed door as the other characters are.
And then we don't even find out that Cecil has been killed in the trenches during World War I until the second section. By that time, 1926, Daphne has married Cecil's brother Dudley, become the famous mistress of Crawley Court, the Valence family home. And George has married as well, because at that time it would have been impossible to live openly as a gay man?
It would have been very difficult for someone. I mean, he's an academic. He's teaching in a provincial university. Yes, I mean, I don't want to give too much away on air about the plot to those who haven't yet read the book, but I think he's typical of a lot of people who were sort of frightened into marriage and an appearance of normality.
And then we mentioned the next section is set in 1967, but then the action moves to 1980, which must have been an easier section to write because you probably remembered a lot better.
In a way, yes, except that then there's more of an abundance of personal memory to draw on. It's quite an interesting difference, the experience of writing the earlier parts before my own time and realizing how kind of literary my sense of the past was, you know, my sense of how people talked and behaved in 1913 largely comes from reading novels set in that period. There was a lot more to sort my way through writing about the 1980 section.
So did people speak much differently in earlier times?
I think they spoke with more formality, probably, and less, and certainly in the sort of social world that I'm describing, with much less slang, yeah.
Although the upper classes sometimes use words like ain't.
Ain't, yes, well, those
affected
sort of cockneyisms, yeah.
And then we go to 2008, where we find out what Cecil's reputation has gone through and other things. The Line of Beauty was made into a TV miniseries. What did you think of it?
I was quite pleased with it in general. I mean, it was my first and so far only experience of having this done to something I'd written. So to me it was very fascinating seeing people that I'd made up, embodied by people with actual, often rather very recognizable features.
And did they look anything like what you'd imagined?
I think the truth is that I have quite a vague physical imagination of my characters. I feel I can kind of see them out of the corner of my eye, but if I look at them full face, they become a blur, and that blur can very easily be inhabited by an actor without it sort of jarring to me. I think I was quite lucky, actually, when you consider how wrong such adaptations can go. I mean, I think it was pretty good.
I'm assuming there's another novel that's been forming in your head. It's going to be... you're going to be prevented from writing it while you're on the book tour, or can you, like some writers, write no matter where you are?
I can't do that, I'm afraid, no, and I'm not nearly ready to start, I must say. I always have quite a fallow period after finishing a book. I usually feel rather emptied out by a book, and it takes a while for the new one to reach critical mass. So I probably won't start writing something until next spring, I guess.
Henry Green, I'm told, could write anywhere. He could write in a hotel, because he was a businessman when he wasn't writing his novels. So he wrote in a hotel, or he wrote wherever he was. It turned out some pretty good books.
But he turned out some masterpieces, yes.
But some writers have to be in a magical place at their desk with the door closed.
I'm afraid I'm very much like that, yeah.
Alan Hollinghurst's latest book is The Stranger's Child. It is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.